So I'm Zachary Peterson. I am a professor of computer science now at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and this is work that I did with my colleague Mark Gondry at the Naval Postgraduate School. And it is, as was stated, about a security board game that we've built. Okay, so let me briefly motivate the problem, as it's probably not really necessary for everyone who's in this room. Let me just say a few words. Talby Survey, ACM have all identified a huge problem in getting people interested in computer science and staying with that interest. So particularly in high school, very, very few high schools offer CS as a program. Even when they do, it's often as an AP course that's an elective, and electives can sometimes be hard to take for those who are college bound. Those who are even interested in computer science don't get offered security until often very late in their careers. I was speaking with a Cal undergrad, and although despite his interests in computer security, he was told he wasn't allowed to take a security course until his junior year. So this is probably, now while I fully believe that Cal has peppered security concepts through their division core, that a dedicated course in security in their junior year is probably far too late. Lastly, I'll say those that are graduating in security, or with an emphasis in security, aren't very diverse, largely male. So why is the case? It's not generally known. There are, particularly in high school, increasingly structured curricula, but there are also some things about computer science that are realities, like the fact that it is expensive, that it, you know, often requires a piece of computer, requires time, which, you know, not all populations of are able to spend time where on a computer. There are perceptions that computer science is only for boys, or that it's extremely isolating, right? And that there are stigmas, you know, that it's for people who are not very popular. Okay, so how do we break these things down and address the kind of huge need that we have for security professionals in this country? All right, so our idea was to build a computer security board game. Okay, so this was designed to get people thinking about and excited about computer security at a much younger age than they normally would through a traditional computer science curriculum. So the idea of a game is that it would be easily incorporated into any curriculum in high school, in computer science undergraduate, or even non-CS courses. Okay, so the kind of the three main tenets of DOXT. So DOXT, I should mention, is a term of art in the hacker world to mean to have your personally identifiable information published online for everyone to see, and that will be actually be a theme in the game. Okay, so the three tenets are DOXT is accessible. So we want DOXT to be engaging to all students, including those who have low computer comfort. Okay. We also want it to be available to them at a low cost, and so we've actually made the game open source and freely available to download. All right, the game is collaborative, and this was a key point, that the game be social, that the game be fun and uncompetitive, and this is important for being inclusive of all genders, both genders, or all genders. And also appropriate for a classroom setting where competition may not be welcomed by a teacher. Okay, or even the students. And lastly, we want it to be fun. So this is actually a game. This is a game that you might play for fun. It has a high replay value. So this is not a training tool. Okay, so let me launch into some of the core mechanics of the game, and then we can start to pick apart some of the design decisions that we made. Okay, so the setting is bad guys have stolen your data, okay? Your sensitive private data, and they've hidden it in their network. And so it's your job to, with your friends, to collaboratively work together and break into this network and steal your data back. And so each player takes on a particular hacker role, and each role has their own special abilities. And as I mentioned, you're supposed to break into this network and recapture four digital assets, which we've named authentication credential, financial data, personally identifiable information, and intellectual property. All right, so let me give you an example of some gameplay. So we'll join three hackers kind of mid-game. And on each player's turn, they do three things. They take actions, they loot, so they draw from a loot deck, and they patch. So let's start with the action phase. Here is the cryptanalyst. And her special ability is to be able to compromise diagonally. Now, normally you are only able to compromise adjacently, up, down, left, and right. And so you'll notice that this board has some missing pieces. That's because some of these machines have been decommissioned. When it is in a white state, I mean it is uncompromised. And when it is an orange state, that means it is compromised. And hackers, of course, could only occupy compromised machines. All right, so as one of the cryptanalysis actions, she can compromise. So she will compromise there. She will then move to that node and drop a digital asset share on that node for maybe one of her partners to come pick up later. Okay, so those were her three actions, to compromise, to move, and to drop. All right, so now she moves to the loot phase, and loot phase is supposed to simulate digging around on the machine and seeing what you can find. Okay, and so you do this by drawing for something called the loot deck, and here she finds the intellectual property share card. And so basically the digital assets have been cryptographically secret split. And so you actually need to capture four of these secret shares, combine them together in order to recapture data. So this kind of represents one share there. So she puts that in her hand. The other thing that she draws is a zero-day exploit. So she's found a vulnerability. And so this is a very powerful card that she'll be able to use at a later point in the game. All right, so that's her loot phase. Then she moves on to the patch phase. And the patch phase is essentially when the system administrators get a turn. And so you look at this InfoCon threat meter, and this is supposed to represent the threat as perceived by the network administrators. So this is essentially the bad guy in the game. And the current token basically says you must draw two patch cards. And so when you draw a patch card, this shows you what machine, what node is going to be patched that round. Well, that one was already patched, so there was nothing to do. The second one, however, is compromised, and so we flip it over. So that limits the team's ability to navigate. If there were things dropped on that, those go away. All right, so now we'll move to the insider's turn. Those were the three phases of one player's turn. So now it's the insider's turn. This is their action phase. All right, and the insider's special ability, seeing as they have direct access to machines, is to be able to compromise faster. And so for one action, they can compromise two machines, okay? Then he's going to move down to the SMTP server, and the SMTP server happens to be a capture point for personally identifiable information. So he's going to trade in his four shares from his hand and collect the PII token, which goes on the shared digital asset drives. And so the goal of the team is to collect all four digital assets and then escape the network before they get caught. Okay, so that's their action phase. The loot phase, so here there's a financial data card. And then he set off the virus signature. And so what this does is actually raise the InfoCon level. And you'll notice now that we will now have to patch three cards. And eventually, if you trip off enough alarms, you move all the way up to InfoCon level one, doxed, and they will, the bad guys will dox your data, right? That's where the name comes from. Okay, so now it is indeed the patch round, and so they'll have to patch three. And so single sign-on service, nothing to do, already patched. And then the wireless router, nothing to do, already patched. And the last one, internet gateway. Now this is problematic. Not only is it compromised, but it's occupied by a hacker. Now normally what this means is that that hacker needs to get off that node, but unfortunately there's nowhere for him to go. And so that hacker would be ejected from the network and the team would lose. Well, fortunately, the cryptanalyst is on this and they're playing together, remember, and so she will play her zero-day exploit card to keep that machine compromised and the team lives to hack another day. Okay, so here are our overarching goals. One is that we wanted to make a game that was approachable and accessible by a much younger audience that would see security. So let's think middle school to high school. We wanted to have pretty modest pedagogical goals. One is we want to introduce terminology, maybe raise awareness, and then create some sort of platform for discussing larger security issues. Okay. We wanted to stimulate adversarial and analytical thinking, things that people sometimes get uncomfortable with in other contexts. So if you ask someone, How would you break into your friend's house? Right? That there are social stigmas in place where you might want to say, well, I don't really want to think about that. I'm not a bad person. But this is the type of thinking that we need to do in order to place ourselves in the minds of an attacker and perhaps find vulnerabilities that we weren't thinking about when we were building a system. Okay. We also, like I mentioned, wanted to provide an opportunity for discussion about larger security issues. We wanted it to be fun. We wanted it to be informal so that you could, you know, this, it felt like play, it felt like fun, and that it'd be accessible. So the way we built, when I'm building this game, is that we got inspiration from a game called Forbidden Island, which is a game designed by Matt Leacock and published by GameRight. Matt's a great guy. GameRight was very, very friendly with us and allowed us to release our game under an open source license so long as it was for non-commercial use. That the things that we liked about this were that it was cooperative play. And there are, I would say, you know, a handful of games out there that are cooperative, but cooperative and strategic. So the reason we like cooperative, one is that it fits nicely into a classroom setting where students aren't necessarily pitted against each other, but also that game researchers have shown that cooperative play is much more inclusive, particularly with women who are not as likely to engage in competitive games. Also, the fact that we have unique roles with special abilities increases interaction and bargaining and kind of group coordination that are, you know, again, kind of nice, useful skills in computer security. We liked Forbidden Island's dynamic game board. We felt this reflected the kind of common attack and defend or the very dynamic nature of a network, and that networks are reconfigurable. And we'll talk more about that later. To Forbidden Island, we then changed, I would say, quite a few mechanics, quite a few of the core mechanics to tell a more interesting security story. So in Forbidden Island, pieces of an island go from being terra firma to being soggy to being sunken. And so we're actually doing the opposite thing, right? And we're kind of unsinking the island. The adversary is trying to patch the network. And so that was kind of one of the core mechanics that we changed. We then tried to pick icons and terminology that would be meaningful. We kind of use our professional judgment to pick pieces of a network infrastructure and places where digital assets might be stored. For example, PII was stored on the SMTP server, right? This isn't that much of a stretch of imagination. And then we picked icons that were by themselves meaningful. And what we ended up choosing to use were open source icons designed for graphical user interfaces. And we tweaked them a little bit, but we hoped that the icons that we chose by themselves evoke some sort of meaning. One of the reasons we wanted to do this was so that we can keep the game language neutral. So Board Game Geek website rates, which is a one-stop shop for all things board games and esoteric about board games. But one of the nice things they have is a language neutrality rating. And so this goes from games that are require almost no language, for example, Uno, right, to games that require quite a bit of language or a lot of reading. So think maybe Steve Jackson's Munchkin. So we tried to make our game very language neutral so that it was easy to play by people who did not necessarily speak the language, that also make the game easily translatable into other languages. In fact, we already have two forks on our GitHub for a Polish translation and a Chinese translation version. Okay, so clearly any physical manifestation of something that's digital isn't going to be a perfect simulation. So we have some clear limitations. One is that the digital assets that we've chosen are pretty arbitrary and perhaps overly general. The network is also very simplistic, right, and really misrepresents adjacency, what it means for things to be connected. However, like any good researcher, we turn our faults into positives, where we've actually identified these limitations quite explicitly in some of the add-on curriculum materials that we've built, and so that we can actually have a discussion about, like, well, do you think this is a real-life network? Or what are digital assets to you? Do they fall neatly into these four categories, or do they kind of span categories? All right, let me talk a little bit of our observations with the game. You know, we've been fortunate to play the game with quite a few groups, and quite the diversity of that group has been pretty high. Oh, that's hard to see, sorry. These are Hartnell Community College students. That's a community college near Salinas. We also play with cyber adventurers. So this is actually one of our prototypes of the game, which is a summer program, a week-long summer program designed to introduce computing concepts to middle schoolers from La Paz Middle School, also in the Salinas area. We took it to North Carolina for an InfoSec conference that they were having there. I was invited to the NSF SFS symposium, where we played with graduating undergraduates who were specializing in computer security. So you actually see here, they've actually combined two versions of, two boxes of Doxed to create a mega network. And they were actually turned this into a competitive game. I didn't quite follow the rules, but they were having a lot of fun. And then most recently, that Cal Poly offers a week-long program for middle school students interested in science and other STEM disciplines. And so we were able to play the game there, along with having a follow-on discussion about digital assets and how to contextualize their digital assets in the real world. Okay, so some of the observations that we've made is that, one, students really like the dynamic nature of the game board, and one of the most natural things that they do, even without prompting, after playing the game once, is to rearrange the game board in such a way that it is impossible to win, or the hardest to win. And so this student at the InfoSec Con was able to put the capture points behind hardened nodes. So there are a few nodes in the game, like the firewall, that require more actions to compromise or are harder to get to. You can also see that he kind of limited the number of adjacent tiles. So this is great, right? This is the type of thinking that a real network architect might do to isolate valuable data or to make certain valuable assets hard to get to. We also turned our limiting digital assets into an exercise for contextualizing in real life. And so as part of the staple game, we offer this customizable asset mat so that students can fill in assets that are maybe their assets or things that are valuable to them. And this was an exercise that came out of the Cyber Adventurers program, where we had students do this. And we got a lot of really cool and varied answers. For example, for intellectual properties, some student offered up, my grandma's secret recipe for fried chicken. Right? Perfect example, and you know, very contextual. I'll say up front, you'll notice we don't have a lot of quantitative data, and I'll get to why that is in just a second. But we have had other people who've taken our game capture some data for us. And generally, people are very positive. So here, a majority of people thought the game was significantly interesting and should be included in the same program next year. So why is gathering data about this stuff hard? And this is maybe a bit of a tangent slash rant, in that IRB is really difficult, particularly maybe difficult generally, but also difficult in the context of a game. Okay, so the one question arises, are games experiments or are there lessons? Okay, so there's this common rule exemption that basically says that if you're doing something as part of your normal educational practice in a place that's commonly accepted as an educational setting, there's an exemption that makes the IRB protocol go a lot faster, the approval go a lot faster. Well, in at least one case, an IRB said, well, we can't determine if this is an experiment or in a lesson, right? Are games really considered part of a common educational practice? And are after-school programs really a commonly accepted educational setting? So they said, we don't know, exemption rejected. Okay. Assessing activities at primary and secondary schools. So beyond the fact that we're interacting with minors, which has its own set of challenges, that there are quite a bit of bureaucratic hurdles, particularly in the state of California, where there was some talk about, well, we're gonna need to get institutional agreement, both from our home institutions, get a memorandum of understanding between our home institutions and these primary and secondary schools, that we as researchers would likely need to get background checks, and that the parents will of course need to approve consent for this experiment, but also that might need copies of the materials. So does that mean we need to buy games for all of the parents? So it kind of became a hurdle that really challenged getting this game out doing research by us. Now there are other kind of loopholes around this, like, no, we can give the game to a teacher, and then they can execute the game and collect data and then give the data to us. All right, more about that another time, perhaps. Also, for Mark and I, who were at the Naval Postgraduate School, interacting with military students, they're a vulnerable population, so there are issues of coercion, that if we can't ask their commanding officer to get them to join, right, then they might not feel like they're able to opt out. Similarly with minors, they're a protected population that have their own sets of consent challenges. So anyways, I put this forward to the community as, if we're really interested in collecting data about education, we really need to solve this IRB problem first. And I would ask that if you've had experiences with IRB or have had successful protocols, publish those. Throw them up on your webpage so that others can learn from them. Right? There's actually nothing secret unless you're using something about deception in your protocol that should limit your publishing of those IRBs. Okay, so here's where we are. We have a game. It is released under Creative Commons, non-commercial, so you can download the game, you can print it yourself, you can remix it, right? We fully encourage you to do so. We've released promotional and instructional videos, so if you'd like to use this game in your classroom, there's a 10-minute video that gives a synopsis of all the rules and is very effective at communicating those rules through our own experiences. We are working on releasing very shortly 3 follow-on exercises and curriculum modules that allow you to actually make some educational sense of the game after the fact. One of those would be exploring digital assets. We've also been able to use the game for a variety of neat student research projects, so in a wide variety of disciplines as well. So there are clearly design elements here. We had a design student at CSUMB design a logo for, and not for this game, but for the overarching project, which we're calling Tabletop Security. We've had students working on a digital version of Doxed, and we have students working on websites, and you know, it's been a really fun way to get students engaged in this project. So this is the website, D0X3D, pronounced Doxed. Let me show you, so it's all available on GitHub. So it's available to print and download on your own. In fact, here's someone on Twitter who did just that. It's also available if you want to get a nicely produced quality version of the game. There's a on-demand print company called The Game Crafter, the gamecrafter.com. And through this, we have sold 297 boxes of Doxed all over the world. Sorry, it's hard to see, but it goes from Adam Shostak up here in Seattle all the way out to Poland and even Turkey. All right, so what's for the future? We have a new version of Doxed that adds new hacker roles and abilities and also a newly shaped game board. And so we wanted to explore new ideas of adjacency so that instead of squares, there are hexagons. We're continuing to, trying to build assessment tools. Now, this is hard generally for computer scientists to build surveys, and so we're contracting for some support in making meaningful assessment tools. We also have a student working on an online card creator so that you can customize your own roles, and so if you want to create your own cards or your own hacker cards, it'll be easy to do so and then be able to print them out at home or even send them to the game grafter. We also have some NSF support for doing a workshop in security games, or both digital and non-digital games. So keep your eyes posted or eyes peeled for a call for participation, because we're not totally sure when it's going to happen yet, but we definitely want to get those who are interested to come together. All right, let me say thanks to our universities and to the National Science Foundation for funding this, and I'll be sure to take any questions that you have right now. Also, I brought a copy of the game so you can play with it, come and look at the pieces. I also brought multiple copies of the game, so if we want to play the game, we can do so tonight or anytime this week. I'll be around. Yeah, in the back.
Also,
Excellent. Thanks for the suggestion. Yes?
Is this at all related to a card game that was being handed out at the NSS?
Yes, sorry. A slide that I did not make it in here. So related work. Control-Alt-Hack is probably the most closely related game. So Yoshi and Tammy Denning at University of Washington, along with Adam Shostak, have created a similar game based upon a Steve Jackson game called Ninja Burger. It's a really fun game. Their pedagogical goals are a little bit different than ours. In fact, they're read their paper. I don't want to put words in their mouth. But my understanding is that it was designed to be really fun and engaging and a tool to talk about security in a casual setting. We're certainly not the only people who are thinking about non-digital games in this space or even kind of play in terms of security. Cyber Siege is a Sims-like game. It came out of the Naval Postgraduate School for doing lessons in computer security, particularly for students who don't have a lot of technical skill yet. There was a paper that appeared here last year, Students Who Don't Understand Access or Information Flow Should Be Eaten, and it was essentially a werewolves type game. There's a whole collection, so sorry, my mind's running a little short right now. There's a whole collection of related work. I point you to our paper to find. Yes?
So there was a lot of very technical terms on those little cards that seemed like very young, perhaps not so technical people in front of them. Do you have any idea how much comprehension the students take away from actually how networks are built? For example, a DNS gateway is not something that I would expect, you know, someone just getting into computers to really understand.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. No, there are lots of terms in there. Even the term zero day, right? That's probably one of the most common card that they'll see and use, and they likely won't know what it is. We've done two things to address that. Well, maybe three. The first is, great, let them see it. Let them wonder what it is, and maybe that'll spark some curiosity, and they can hop on Wikipedia or they can ask somebody. Two is that we provide some definitions for the most commonly used terms in the instruction book. And then three, we want to use that as an opportunity to have that discussion about terms. I mean, how do we leverage a conversation about what a firewall is, and why is this firewall card harder to compromise than the rest of them? So then we can turn that into, you know, sorry, the trite teaching moment. Yes, one more minute. Any final, yes? Yes. Okay. So the answer is yes and no. The answer is the yes part is we do have a student who's actively working on creating a digital version of the game, likely to be playable on a variety of platforms, including the web. The no part is now we deliberately made a choice to make this a non-digital game. Right? There are aspects of analog games that allow for communication and human interaction that get lost sometimes when you're staring at a screen. And so it was an experiment to see if we could bring other students who are not interested in staring in front of a screen to the table. No pun intended. Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody.